Welcome to Let's Talk About Test Baby, a fortnightly podcast where I leave passive-aggressive post-it notes on software testing's door. Hello listeners, and welcome to episode 63 of Let's Talk About Test Baby. My name is Jem Hill, and this week it's the last in our block of interviews, and I'm talking to Andy Tinkham about modern testing, which is a philosophy that you may have heard of if you listen to other testing podcasts. He's been on a couple. But I hope even if you have, you listen to this one because it touched on some different things and I really enjoyed the conversation. And I hope you do too. Let's get on with it. So this week on the podcast, I'm talking to Andy Tinkham. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Jem. How are you today?
I'm really good. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. Thank you.
Good. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Oh, my pleasure.
So we're on this week talking about modern testing, which is your kind of testing philosophy, I guess.
Yeah, philosophy is a good word for it.
Cool. So you've been on a couple of podcasts talking about it already, haven't you? Been on test?
Yeah, I was on the testing show with Matt Heuser and Justin Rohrman and Michael Larson were on that day. Mm-hmm. And then I've been on Joe Colantonio's Test Talks.
Cool. I've listened to both of those. I love those podcasts and they were good episodes. And so when you reached out to me, I was really interested in see what we could do that was, while still giving an overview of the philosophy, what was going to be slightly different to those two shows. Because I'm aware that probably people who listen to testing podcasts will probably listen to more than one.
Most likely, yeah, I would agree.
Yeah, so my thoughts were to go into a brief overview of philosophy just in case people somehow were listening to this one first and not heard the other two, although I do recommend the other two as well. And then maybe go into, because from my point of view, it's really interesting because I still class myself as a new tester because I've only been doing it a couple of years. And there's a lot of philosophy sort of going around and a lot of them are almost kind of a little bit intimidating. You know, there's a lot of sort of set in stone stuff, whereas this seemed a lot more useful because you can kind of, it almost encourages you to pick and choose the bits that make sense.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to differentiate from a methodology as I was coming up with this. You know, a methodology tells you what to do. And there are so many different scenarios out there that we test in. And working as a consultant, I run into many of them in the course of my career. That I was looking for more guidance on how to think about what to do rather than guidance on what to do.
So let's take it back a step and go into the philosophy itself. So it's called modern testing and it's made up of pillars, yes?
Yep. There are four pillars. They are context first. Testers are not robots. Use multiple lenses for test design. And focus on providing useful, timely, needed information.
Those pillars are named quite well. They kind of tell you what they are, pretty much just from the title. The only one that I think I really dove deep into because I didn't know right on the surface what it was the one about multiple lenses.
Yeah.
Because I'd not heard the phrase lenses used in that context before. So multiple lenses is the different ways you can look at testing one piece of functionality almost.
Right, yeah. So the idea of a lens is it's a metaphor for a mental model. And just like if we're looking through a telescope, some things are going to be very clear. Mm-hmm. Some things are going to be very hard to see. And if we look through a microscope, a different set of things are going to be clear and a different set of things are going to be hard to see. Different lenses, when we're talking about software, enable us to see different aspects of the software that we're testing. I thought that I had come up with it, but I've since found it in, I think Elizabeth Hendrickson has written about it. I'm sure others have. Many of the things that go into modern testing, I'm positive I've been influenced by a number of smart people. So I'm giving clear credit to Elizabeth in this case for the lenses.
What made you decide to put this together in a formal way? Was there any sort of one moment that sort of spark this, or is it just like a combination of lots of different things?
The answer to that is actually both.
Okay.
I've worked as a practice lead for a consulting company, for a couple consulting companies now, for nearly the last 5 years. And at the first company, the one that I left a little over a year ago, my role was largely vision, philosophy, how do we approach things? And my current role is even more of that with also more of the management type activities in it. Mm-hmm. I went from a bigger company to a smaller company. those two, with the two consulting companies, went from one with a national presence in the U.S. to one that's much more focused in my my local metropolitan area of Minneapolis. And while I was at the first company, when I was at Magenic, there I was drawing largely on the principles of context-driven testing, the work that I did in grad school when I was down at Florida Tech studying with Kem Kaner, interacting with other people in the testing field. And that worked really, really well. But I had a growing sense of not fitting with what we were seeing with our clients. And it wasn't that context-driven testing wasn't fitting, but it was as close as I can imagine feeling like the metaphor of being pregnant, not actually being feeling pregnant. I'm being male. I'm probably never going to experience that. But the, you know, it felt like something was germinating, was building, and I couldn't really tell what it was. And I had that feeling for a couple of years there, that that there was change coming in testing and we needed to adapt to it. And that context-driven testing gave me parts of it, but it didn't feel like everything was completely falling in place. So that was kind of the building up series of moments. Then when I switched to my current company, C2 Solutions, there are at least three other consultancies focused just on testing, and a number of consultancies that have testing and other aspects of software development in town. C2 does have multiple practices as well, but QA is our biggest one. And one of the things that the organization was struggling with when I came in was, how do we differentiate ourselves from our competition? Mm-hmm. You know, it is easy for software testing consultancies to basically become or probably any consultancies for that matter, to fall into a race to the bottom pricing trap.
Yeah.
And our current population of consultants is made up of a mix of salaried employees, hourly employees, and independent contractors. And when you've got that kind of mix where people are always going to be looking around for the best deal, and when you've got times when people aren't being paid if they're not billing, they're even more looking around. So I wanted to differentiate ourselves both for our clients to have them say, we want to work with you because we believe in your philosophy and how you approach testing. We think there is value. We think there is difference there. And I wanted to differentiate ourselves to attract the best consultants in town who I want to say, we want to work with you, again, for those same reasons, because it's not just the run-of-the-mill stuff that they can go anywhere, and then it becomes a, for the consultant, who's going to pay me the most, and for the client, who's going to charge me the least.
Yeah.
Which leaves the consulting company stretched. So that was really kind of the okay, I really have to get this defined impetus moment.
Yeah.
And then we kind of grew from there.
Another thing that caught my attention when I was listening to the other podcast you've been on was the testing manifesto challenge, where you challenge people to write down their own manifesto for testing. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Oh, yeah. So we talked about modern testing having pillars. There are actually a set of principles that I distilled down into the pillars first.
Mm-hmm.
And the principles came before the pillars.
Okay.
Those principles arose, again, from influences across the industry that I did draw from the specific principles of the context-driven school. But the impetus for pulling those together was that I was on a project with a client, and the client had brought me and my team in to come in, take a look at what they were doing for current testing practices, understand how quality was being perceived in the organization and by the customers, and then make some recommendations about things that they might do to improve, give them some priorities, basically give them an outside view of how to get better at what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah.
And the manager who brought us in was perpetually booked. It was very hard to get time on his calendar. But I knew that he was one of the people that we needed to interview as part of this assessment process to really understand what he was trying to achieve and his vision. Yeah. And we finally got that interview, and we were going through, and there was something that he said, and I don't even remember what the specific thing was anymore, but I knew that it was something that didn't match my view of testing.
Okay.
But I also knew that if we pursued it and had a discussion, we'd probably have a really great discussion, but I wouldn't be able to finish the interview that I was being paid to do. So I basically left it as, well, I think you and I might have some differences of opinion there, and I'd be happy to talk about them with you at some point if you want, but right now we need to finish the interview, and so we'll table that. And most of the time when I throw that out, you know, the client manager will say, yep, well, it was great, and then it never comes up. But this time it didn't. And the manager was working for a company that had offices both in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Atlanta, Georgia, which is something maybe like a 3 to 4 hour drive or something like that.
Okay.
And his company was close enough of a drive that the company wouldn't let managers fly back and forth between the locations. They had to drive.
Okay.
And he had team members in both places, so he made that trip frequently. And he said, you know what, you know, in a couple days, I'm going to be driving back from Atlanta. Call me when I get out of the city, and you know, we can talk through it while I drive back. And that led me to say, oh, I think I probably better need to pull together an outline of things that we want to talk about. And that, so that led to, there's a post on my blog at testerthoughts.com called I Believe, ... and sadly, it is the second to last post on my blog, and I posted it 2 years ago. So, but anyhow, it's there, and it's on the front page. And so as I was planning for this conversation, I started writing, okay, these are the things that I think about testing, and just wrote them down, organized them a little bit, and then we talked through that. And we had a great conversation on the way back. And that led to so much more insight into what I hold to be true around testing that I took that exercise and I started talking to my practice members about it. I encouraged them and I said, you know, this is a great exercise to really assess and understand and clarify in your head what you think about testing. A couple of them did it and really liked the results. And then I talked to Chris Kenst at one point and he did it and posted his results on his blog. And then it's kind of, I talked about it on the testing show. And I think that's where you heard about it.
Yeah.
And I just love the exercise.
No, I think it's really good. I was listening in the gym, actually, and I had to actually record, rewind the podcast to make sure I'd heard that little bit right of what, like, the challenge and stuff. And then I was thinking about it all the way through the rest of my workout and all the way home. And then I sat home and just bullet pointed it all out because I realized during my workout session that while I thought I had lots of things in my head about testing, none of them were actually that concrete. I couldn't distill them down.
Really?
It was very much sort of, oh, I believe this, but also maybe this. And not contradiction, but there were lots of caveats and lots of, like, my sentences were getting longer and longer in my head.
Uh-huh.
I realised it was just, I'd read so much stuff about testing and so many different opinions that I'd agreed with mostly, but I'd never actually put them together into one coherent view of testing before.
Okay.
And so, like I said, I sat down and I've got the bullet points in the document that I've shared with you about this, but I still haven't managed to get it into anything more than just bullet points because I probably haven't had time, but I just found it really interesting that, because I said new tester, I just, especially doing the podcast as well, I've consumed so much stuff, but I've never actually sat down and like studied the output of all that stuff that's in my head now. And so I found it like incredibly useful and interesting just to think, what do I know what other people believe, I know what other people say, but what do I actually think and believe? And what do I practice in my day-to-day work, which sometimes can be different?
Yep.
But what bits of that do I actually want to take out and what bits do I think are good and go into this sort of manifesto or philosophy of testing?
Yeah, and you know, you talked about only having in bullet points and not having done more with it. Bullet points are fine. I think that... You know, I would call my blog post still bullet points. Now, I tend to the wordier side of writing. The fact that I have worked with my marketing person is why there are short, succinct titles for the pillars of modern testing. She made me cut back many, many words that were in there.
Mm-hmm.
So bullet points are great. I think that it makes it easier to approach and easier to remember.
Yep, that is true. It was a lot less intimidating. I was like, right, forget trying to make full sentences. Let's just get bullet points down and see what comes out.
Earlier this year, there was a reinventing testers workshop that James and John Bach did up in Washington State.
Mm-hmm.
And early in that workshop, Rob Saborin was there, and he summed up we were having a discussion about what does it actually mean to reinvent testing? What's a reinvented tester? And he summed up the that discussion and his thinking and the thinking of the group by saying that a reinvented tester is someone who understands the essence of testing and knows how to apply their skills as context changes around them. And I really see this thinking through of what do I personally believe as a critical step in getting to that essence of testing and moving beyond just, well, so-and-so says this is what good testing is, so that's what I should do. But really driving down to, I think this is what the right thing to do in this context is.
Absolutely, absolutely. If you do this challenge, you don't ever actually have to share it with anyone else.
Very true.
Yep. Which is true, because I think sometimes there's because the testing community is so big and so passionate, and because there's so many different contexts, I think sometimes it can be a bit intimidating to share things.
Mm-hmm.
And especially something where it is just your own, you know, thoughts and philosophy on testing. So even if you don't actually have to share it, you can just write it down, get it in your head, realize you've got a solid foundation there to work with, and then just never share it with anyone. It's still perfectly valuable, even if you don't ever put it on a blog or whatever.
Absolutely, yeah. The initial burst of value comes from clarifying your own thinking.
Absolutely. I think there's definitely, because I hand wrote it out first before I typed it. And I found that incredibly, I always find that really useful, like handwriting things anyway, because it forces me to slow down and think about it, because I write much slower than I type.
That's really interesting, because I hadn't thought about it, but I did mine by handwriting first too.
Yeah, so for me it was, I write really slowly because my handwriting is terrible. And so having that such a difference from thoughts, which are generally fast and not very well formed, to having to think about it and write it out manually, like having to make my muscles move to form the words.
Yep.
Just really made me slow down and think about it. And I crossed out so many things and rewrote so many things. And it took like ages just to get like a form that I was vaguely happy with, just because it was right. Okay. No, that's not right. I'm going to try again. And so I've listened to both the episodes about modern testing previously, and I find that really useful, like the whole philosophy, but just the manifesto challenge, I got so much value out of that just by itself that it's just incredible.
Very cool. I'm super excited to hear that. On the subject of sharing it, well, it, like we said, it is very useful just to do it and not share it. When there are situations where you feel comfortable sharing it with an individual, not necessarily even publicly posting it, but just sharing it, I think that also leads to some very interesting discussions, both with my practice members and then when Chris posted his. You know, there was some back and forth when we were like, really? That's how you think? And then we explained it. And I think certainly I learned from those situations. So I think there can be value there, but absolutely, it is the main piece is clarifying your own thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I plan to publish mine probably with the blog post that goes with this episode, because I think there is some value from that. But I said just the writing it down and just keeping it there was great as well.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that every tester go through the exercise at some point in their career.
Absolutely, absolutely. So I am aware that I asked about the multiple lenses for test design pillar and then ignored all the other pillars. So maybe useful to go through the other three and just give a short overview of what they are. Because although the names are really self-explanatory, it would still be good to get an overview of what they are and how you intended them to come across to people.
Sure. So context first is the first pillar. And that is in response to... I see, particularly working as a consultant, which certainly skews my viewpoint, I see a lot of testers who've been in the field for a while. They have this mental image of what good testing is.
Mm-hmm.
And it involves certain activities or artifacts or deliverables or patterns of interaction or whatever they feel defines good testing. And they go into a new project, a new context, and they try to force that vision of good testing on the project.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it works really well. Sometimes it works really poorly. And most of the time it's somewhere in the middle. Mm-hmm. And there's often cases where people get frustrated, where well, if they'd only do this activity too, then all our quality problems would go away type thinking comes up.
Yeah.
And that just doesn't really work well. So by recognizing that that context comes first, that what I'm saying is that the context of the project, the people involved, the processes that are in place already, what is the mission of the test group for this particular testing effort? Are we trying to do a high-level quick check, or are we trying to make sure that we're not going to kill anybody because we're working on medical devices or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
The availability of specifications. Are we in a shop that does a pretty good job of identifying requirements or user stories? Are we working off just a single hallway conversation we overheard? Those are things that are going to influence what we can do for testing and what the right activities are. What resources do we have available? The deadlines that are in place. And so all of these things and understanding this context that we're in,
that defines what good testing is for us.
So I was going to say, so you say context first. So I'm assuming, like, obviously all the pillars are important, but by putting context first, because the context informs how you attack the other pillars as well. So I guess that is kind of, it's got to be first. It's kind of the most important in the certain sense of that gives you the information that will feed through to the other pillars.
Right. Yep. And there is a lot of intertwining, but most of it is the context into the other pillars. Yep. And then there's some other pieces in here around that. And some of that is the there is no best practices part of context-driven testing, where the word best, when we talk about best practices, discourages us to think about whether this is the right practice for our context. It's already got best in the title. There is nothing better than best by definition. And so if this is a best practice, why would I even consider it? I need to do that. And then there's also the concept of shallow agreement, of recognizing that when I say quality and you say quality and all the people on our project together say quality, we may not mean the exact same thing. But we tend to assume that we do, and sometimes that gets us in trouble as well. So all of these things roll up into that first pillar. Then the second pillar is that testers are not robots. One of the things that I feel is that the model of testing where we do a bunch of thinking and come up with some test plans and script out all the actions and then turn that pile of scripts over to a person to run, perhaps even with an evaluation of their performance based on how quickly they could get through them, basically is a dehumanizing activity. We can do the same thing with computers. We call it automation. And recognizing that testing is a human activity, that it is a human activity that can be supported by automation and should be supported by automation in most contexts, but it is still a human first activity. And we need to gear our activities that we have our testers and our automation do to take advantage of the strengths of both humans and computers. A good example of that, there's a client that I've worked for, still working for, that's a manufacturing client. And you can go on their website and you can order something on the order of 1,000 different combinations for the stuff they manufacture. And when they would change pricing, or they would change functionality on the website and the configurator and all that, when they had humans doing the testing, they couldn't come anywhere near testing all 1,000 plus combinations. So they'd sample. They'd do 5, a dozen, maybe as high as 20 or 30 if it was a big change. But there were a lot of combinations that they left undone. And we were able to create some automation for that particular aspect of their site that actually did put every possible combination into the shopping cart and made sure the pricing stayed the same all the way through, the promotions got applied appropriately. And that is a great example of where it makes sense to have automation do it. Automation isn't going to mix up data rows in its head. It's not going to get blurry-eyed and fall victim to signal detection problems and things like that.
Not going to get bored out of the skull and decide it's not exactly worth it. It's fine.
Nope. Yeah, and there are other parts where a human makes much more sense to have execute the test, whether it's looking for the unexpected, whether it's pattern matching, whether it's any of a number of strengths that people have, mm-hmm. recognizing that and planning a strategy accordingly. Recognizing that that human is going to keep learning while they're working through the process, and that when we write a bunch of scripts up front, we know the least about the application that we're going to know in that test cycle, mm-hmm. is we're going to keep learning and making room for that.
Yeah.
And then bringing automation in to support those efforts where it makes sense.
Yeah, just give testers, use it to give testers space to actually use their brains and do that kind of stuff.
Yep, exactly. The third we touched on a little bit already with the different lenses. We didn't go from the metaphor down to examples of specific lenses.
Yeah.
So requirements is a lens that I would say nearly every tester tends to use. And just like any model is a simplification of the system, or it would be the system itself, requirements give us a model of the system. And there are lots of aspects that they define, and it can be, depending on the skill of the analyst creating them, there can be more or less definition in those requirements. And I'm using requirements in the general sense, user stories, specifications, anything that says this is what the system should do.
Mm-hmm.
But the way that analysts tend to think, the way that developers tend to think, is the way that the system should work when it's working.
Yeah, yeah.
So that requirements lens gives us a skewed view of the possible tests to ones that are more focused to this is the way it should work when the system's complete. Mm-hmm. And that's very important.
Yeah.
But it's only one portion of the set of tests. And we could use risk, for example, as another lens. We could look at features and say, how could this feature fail? How would I know if it was a problem? And then turn that into a test.
Yeah.
And that's going to give us another skewed set. It's going to give us a set that's skewed very much towards the getting off into the weeds, the places where assumptions get violated, where errors occur. And that's another important set of tests. But then all of the illities, the non-functional requirements, and security and performance, and all of those things are things that we could take a conscious effort and say, I'm going to think about this system from the standpoint of security, for instance.
Yeah.
And where might my data be vulnerable, or where might we run the risk of, if we have multiple users, where they're crossing their data streams somehow and getting access to each other's information. And that's going to lead us to get another set of tests. And too many testers that I've run into in my career tend to stop after the requirements. They go through a very almost mechanical process of requirement one, test case one, maybe test case two, test case three, requirement two, test case, test case, test case. And they stop there and they miss the other aspects of the landscape of possible tests that they could run.
Yeah.
And then the fourth pillar is needed and timely information. And that reflects that testing is largely an information providing activity. We're not going in and fixing the defects. We're not changing the design in most cases. We might in some instances, in some contexts, but most of the time we're not. And our team, our stakeholders, are trying to make decisions based on the quality of the system. So working with them to understand what are their actual questions, driving it past the kind of standard, here's the raw data dump of I ran X number of tests out of Y total number of tests and Z passed, that puts a lot of the interpretation burden on the people we're communicating to.
Yeah.
And in modern testing, we need to take back some of that interpretation so that we're very clear in the message we're providing that, and we're answering the actual questions they have. Very few managers want a specific number of test cases unless they've learned that this is how I figure out how well tested is that feature. More tests is better.
Yeah, yeah.
And so tailoring it is really that fourth pillar.
The concept of testing being largely information providing was almost kind of a revelation for me when I realized actually that's what I'm doing, because so much of when I first got in to testing, I was kind of just focused on finding defects because that's kind of what I assumed that my job was.
Okay.
And it took me a long time to get out of that mindset of, if I've not found any defects, maybe I've not tested it properly, or maybe I've missed something, that then I realised that it doesn't matter if I've not found anything, because I've learned stuff. And that's, something in some cases, even more important than if I'd found a bug in it.
Sure, yep.
And so having that kind of, having that separated out as a separate thing that is actually important, as opposed to, well, at least I found some information, was kind of like, oh yeah, okay, I can just say that that is what I'm doing, and that's quite important. I find that quite helpful to think about.
Yep. Yeah, there's a concept that Michael Bolton wrote about on his blog, where he talks about three stories that braid together in test reporting, where he talks about the first story being the quality of the application. So what did we see working? What did we see not working? And what can we extrapolate from that? And I think that that piece is where the defects come in, or the lack of defects.
Yeah.
And then there's more stories behind it to justify that. So there's, what did we do to come to that conclusion? Because saying, yeah, you know, I logged into the application and it all looked good is very different than I came up with it with these sets of tests using these different lenses, and here's the risks I was looking for, and I didn't find anything going wrong. Mm-hmm. And then taking very similarly to the fourth pillar of modern testing, where there's an element of taking back the communication of our message and not just, here's our raw data, make of it what you will. The third story in Michael's post is the story of the quality of the testing. And so rather than making our audience be mentally put themselves in the role of tester and say, okay, well, if I were a tester, what would I do here? And do I feel like that was enough testing or not? We communicate that based on our own experience, and that really fleshes out that whole message that we're conveying to our stakeholders.
Yeah, it also makes the testing visible, because I think a lot of people don't really realize what testing is. And I think part of that is it's on us to actually draw attention to and communicate that. And providing that sort of information does then suddenly make the testing incredibly open and visible, and this is what we actually do, and this is what we think about when we do it, as opposed to just like shoving work into a person and then numbers and bugs or whatever come out.
I hadn't drawn the connection there, but one of the clients that I'm working with now is kind of in that scenario where their QA group is doing good work, but most of the organization isn't really aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the recommendations I've been making have been around changing the information providing, and I never drew that parallel you just made. So thank you.
Yeah. It's something that I do at work a lot, because when we first got in, the company was about 7 years old when they got their first testers.
Okay.
And so while a lot of developers were very happy about us coming in and wanting us in on the planning and stuff, some developers, there was this sort of feeling that they were just throwing stuff at us and just, oh, it's fine. It's QA's job to catch all these bugs and find they weren't like looking at their work or whatever at all. And so for some of the ones that I end up working with, I just force them in a way. I started talking the scrums about what I was doing and why I was doing what I was doing. And I'd go sit next to them. I wouldn't file the bug until I sat next to them and actually talk through what I'd done and what I was looking for.
Uh-huh.
And I just noticed that I had one guy come over to me actually yesterday to show me the work on his local machine, and went, right, these are the scenarios that I've tested. These all work fine. You may find other ones, but this is what I've done before I'm pushing it live. And it actually just done a load of testing on it.
Uh-huh.
Because I'd spent so much time going, right, these are the scenarios that I'm doing, these are the issues that I found, that they've just started testing like the basics for me.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, so I'm a big fan of providing information about what I'm doing at every possibility, that every... So, you know, whenever it makes sense and there's time to do so, I will just do it because I've seen it give great results.
I like that. That's good.
Where can people find you, Andy, if they want to find out more?
So where can people find me? The best place is my hub website, andy.tinkham.org, T-I-N-K-H-A-M, which I believe is actually a good English spelling.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I, as an aside, this is tangents, why not? I did one of those ancestry DNA tests, and apparently I'm like 98% English.
Oh, really?
Really, yep. There was like trace amounts of something else, but pretty much English. That's it. And it was the test actually even did, you know, typical person living in the UK, and they were only like 60%. So apparently I'm super English or something.
Yeah, more English than all other English people.
Anyhow, andy.tinkham.org. Twitter, where I'm Andy Tinkham. Twitter, you're going to get a wide, actually both places, you're going to get a wide size, both testing stuff, and I have a photography print business on the side. So all of those come together in both those places, and that's probably the best place to go.
Awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And that is that for this week. Thank you so much for listening. As I mentioned, I did publish my manifesto on testing. It's just some bullet points. That is on the show notes for this episode, as well as some other stuff that we talked about, links to other episodes of podcasts that Andy's been on, as well as all past episodes. There's also all the contact details on there. If you want to email, it's letstalkabouttests@gmail.com, at letstalktests on Twitter, at letstalkabouttests on Skype. And last but definitely not least, if you enjoyed the show and you want to help us out, drop us a review and a rating on iTunes. That actually really helps. And thank you for listening. I'll be back in a fortnight. Bye.